you know, we were praying right before this for those that are listening in. And one of the things that came out in your prayer, Daniel, was just that books can really spark an interest in somebody's life. There can be moments in people's lives where a book can change everything. And I really believe that. We wouldn't be in this business, actually, if we didn't believe this, that books can be transformative. Sometimes it's a slow burn. It's just one more piece of the puzzle. It's an enjoyment. It's an edification. But there are books that just become transforming. And in that moment, you know, everything's different. So we pray that these books and recommended that something clicks for somebody.
Welcome to the Upwards Podcast, where we discuss the intersection of Christian faith in the academy, church, and marketplace. My name is Daniel Johnson, and I'm your host for today's podcast. I welcome back Byron Borger from Hearts and Minds Bookstore. He's the owner there and a wealth of knowledge on what we should be reading this fall. We discuss a variety of different subjects and different book titles and themes. We talk about theology books. What should we be reading to shape our theology currently in this moment that we're in? We talk about culture, and we actually talk about some resources about how to engage culture and also culture making. We talk about memoirs and the importance of reading memoirs and what they do for our souls and how they intersect with us in our own faith. And finally, Byron has some great resources for Christian students who are entering college. And what should they be doing? How should they be interacting both with professors and the greater community within the university or college structure? We hope you enjoy today's episode. Now on to our conversation. Welcome to the Upwards Podcast. My name is Daniel Johnson. We're so excited to have a fan favorite, we say around here, Byron Borger, back to talk about fall books. We feel the season's changing here in Madison, Byron, and students are back on campus. Our first football game is tonight. We're excited to have all the students back, but it does feel like fall. It's been cool here for the last kind of week or so, and we're excited to see what the Lord's going to do this fall here with us on campus.
Well, our bookstore is in South Central Pennsylvania. We're down below Harrisburg, which is sort of the middle of the state. So we're in South Central PA. And it has been cool here, too. It really feels like fall. It's been a hot, dry summer, but boy, it feels nice the last couple of days. And I know friends that do campus ministry in various organizations, the CCO out of Pittsburgh and InterVarsity and stuff. They're all back on campus. I see their Facebook posts of doing back-to-campus events and meet the student stuff and loading in. And so, yeah, it's that time of year. It's exciting.
Yeah, I know we've talked in the past about kind of the seasons changing and kind of what that does to kind of some of our reading habits. And, you know, kids are going back to school and, you know, we're definitely on an academic calendar here. So it definitely feels changey. But I think those families that, you know, are sending kids back off to school in a week or so here, you know, it feels like a different season. It feels like something's different in the air. And I think, you know, when those things happen, it's interesting to see how, what comes forward, you know, a really good book coming forward, a movie, a recipe, you know, it's just an interesting time of the year when we see these seasons change. I think the Lord leads us to discover new things about ourselves and our formation in that. So, well, Byron, I'm going to open it up to you. I think the question that I asked you was, what should we be reading this fall? And I know that you're going to come with amazing recommendations like you always do. So why don't you kick us off?
Well, you know, we were praying right before this for those that are listening in. And one of the things that came out in your prayer, Daniel, was just that books can really spark an interest in somebody's life. There can be moments in people's lives where a book can change everything. And I really believe that. We wouldn't be in this business, actually, if we didn't believe this, that books can be transformative. Sometimes it's a slow burn. It's just one more piece of the puzzle. It's an enjoyment. It's an edification. But there are books that just become transforming. And in that moment, you know, everything's different. So we pray that these books and recommended that something clicks for somebody, because they're at Upper House. You're in this long process of helping students and faculty develop a kingdom vision for their lives, for the rest of their lives. So this stuff has got to take. Hey, I'll tell you one thing, just before I even get started in proper, there's a new friend that you have, a person working for you up there, Joy Fia, who was from central Pennsylvania, and then her husband, John, who was a very dear friend. And so right here's the first book I'm going to recommend. It's called Why Study History? And it's one of several that John has written. He's a historian. He was on staff here at Messiah College near us. But this Why Study History is in a second edition. It reflects on the importance of the past, of being a scholar that's attentive to things in the history of culture. So it's for anyone, but certainly history majors. He has more academic stuff on historiography and the philosophy of history. But this little book, Why Study History, is by John Fia, who is up there as a visiting lecturer this year. And his wife's working for Opera House, right?
Yeah. So Joy just joined our team. She's our new director, what we call Opera House Commons, which is all kind of all of our public facing events. And so she's been on staff with us a couple of weeks, and they've moved to Madison. And it's been such a joy to have them here with us in Madison so far.
Well, we lost a bit of a customer because he would come in sometimes, and we've had him lecture here at the store already, too. So give him my regards if they're listening in, or if anybody in the team hasn't met John and Joy yet. They're wonderful, wonderful people. He's a Jersey guy. He's a Springsteen fan, so that's kind of fun. Well, look, you're talking about the new season of the fall, and although you have faculty and graduate professionals, you know, working with you there, I'd like to suggest something that might be good for students. Or I think for teachers, this is kind of a rare book, and I might have shared it with you before because I like it so much, but it's by a professor named Alex Sossler. Alex has a book on aesthetics. Happens to be an Anglican priest, but he's on staff at Montreat College, which is in North Carolina, Montreat, an evangelical Christian college. And he wrote a book for first year students. Now, I'll just say as a caveat that it's written presuming that students are going to a Christian college, you know, like your Calvins or your Wheatons or your Gordons or Taylor. But having said that, I think this book is great for undergrads of any source starting in the fall to wonder, why are you in college in the first place? The book is called Learning to Love. Have we talked about this before? It's called Learning to Love.
Yeah.
The subtitle is Christian Higher Education as a Pilgrimage. Well, if you're a person of faith, then you are in Christian higher education, if you will. So granted, it was written for Montreat, but I think it's good for anybody. And what this book does, it develops sort of a fictional device of a student going off to classes. And with some advisement from some older mentors, he chooses what classes to take, meets up different professors, and the professors guide him on this pilgrimage, if you will, a John Bunyan kind of story. And he goes to these different colleges, as he calls them, and he meets different perspectives, if you will. The first one is the College for Thinkers, and that's in the city of Big Brains. And then he goes to the College for Workers, where the main place there is you're trying to just create a job so you can be successful. And then there's a critics of all that, and they value authenticity, just being yourself, you know. And so he has these three different sort of models of education that you might find at a Christian college, even, certainly there at Madison. You're going to find people that are all about just the success of your academic career, your brainiacs. You know, you're going to find people that want successful for the workforce. You just want to get something on your resume so you can get a good job someday. And then there's people that just want to be true to themselves and be authentic and creative and express whatever. All of those don't seem to have biblical norms that shape the process of higher learning. So he contrasts that, where the pilgrim ends up at a college for lovers. Where you learn to love stuff. You learn to care about the stuff God cares about. You learn to care about stuff in the right way. You know, St. Augustine said that the main problem with our sin is that it disorders our loves. We love the wrong things, or we love things, good things, in the wrong way. And so it's about priorities and love and shape and order to your life. And he says that's really what college can do. It can help you love well. Love God, love others, love your career, love creation. And then that's the sort of a rest stop after that. So he's sort of critiqued wrong views of education, invited you to this pilgrimage of love, and then says after a rest stop, which is itself a great chapter, he says learning is a gift. And so God's grace is the foundation for learning. Then learning to love is a posture, and he calls that charity, the virtue of charity. And then you begin to learn to belong to something, to someone and to someone, a guild. You love as a motive for education itself. You love as a practice, that's about wisdom. You love in community, and you're learning to love even the broken places because your education is going to equip you to serve God's needy world. And so in community with others, you make a difference. So it walks you through this sort of learning to commit to the right kind of stuff in the right kind of way, driven by charity, by love, by virtue. There is no other book that's as fun and interesting and curious, because it's written so cleverly, that is actually remarkably profound. Studying Jamie Smith, studying Wendell Berry, I mean, the citations and stuff, you can tell this Alex Hostler has done some good philosophical work. But it ends up being a really fun book about the purpose of college, and it's kind of different and almost whimsical at times. It's a really good read, and so it's about the power of love in the classroom. I love it.
That's great. That's great.
I think if you're a teacher, you need to understand what it means to teach like that. So even though you may be a devout Christian and I've got a PhD in mathematics or computer science or political theory, you know, are you helping your students step into that as a process of their becoming an ordered lover of God's world? And so even if professors read this sort of lighthearted book about learning and the different models of learning as they pilgrimage through the settings of higher education, I think it would be good for professors. But certainly if you're a young student trying to figure what's it all about, it's a great little read. I wanted to start with that one. Now, here's a second one that I'm going to put right on the heels of that. This isn't about higher education as such, but it sort of just follows that if you love stuff, if you're curious, if you have the Christian mind, if you're thinking as you do at Upper House, inviting students to have an integral perspective relating their faith and their scholarship, once you're doing that, you have to learn the art of asking good questions. Learning is so much about curiosity and receiving God's word as a gift and God's insight in his creation as a gift, but that means exploring some stuff, including what's wrong with the world, because we live in a fallen world. So we study God's ordinances in the world, but we also study how messed up it is. It can be heartbreaking. And so learning how to probe all that in relationship with others, whether it's faculty, whether it's classmates, whether it's seekers or Christians that don't understand your passion or non-believers, no matter who you're interacting with, you got to learn the skill set of being a good listener to answers. And they're provoked by asking good questions. So the book is new. It is called The Art of Asking Better Questions. It's by a pastor down in Philly named J.R. Briggs. He's got this missional energy. I like J.R. a lot. Listen to the subtitle: Pursuing Stronger Relationships, Healthier Leadership, and Deeper Faith. So in your relationships, in your leadership capacities as a leader on campus, and even in your own faith life, as you begin to ask God questions or listen to the questions God asks us. There's an appendix in the bottom about how Jesus' style of mentoring people was often asking questions. There's hundreds of questions that Jesus himself asked in the Gospels. So this sort of takes that as an inspiration and just says, what are the key to a deeper life, to a more meaningful learning experience in college and beyond, lies in the questions that you ask? So I thought those two might be good starters for students, learning to love well in higher education and learning to ask good questions on campus.
Yeah. I mean, both of those, Byron, I think of kind of an embodied experience with those. You know, I mean, so much of college life right now is, you know, students are coming in really isolated. Maybe they're in their dorm room a lot. They go to class, they go back to their dorm room. You know, they have to kind of push themselves into social situations. That's just not a natural tendency for the Generation Z. And I think of both of those as equipping to help have that embodied experience within the academy.
Yeah. Just to get us rolling here, too, as we're thinking about discipling students and giving them a vision for why this stuff matters, I'll tell you about another one that I think is really just a useful book, because it's so delightfully written. Again, it's not a hard read, but it's gracious and thoughtful. It's an author named Bobby Jameson. And Bobby Jameson is a respected pastor, and he wrote this new book called Everything is Never Enough. You know, again, we're chasing these idols in the college career of success and good grades and a future job and stuff on your resume and so forth. It's almost like, what isn't enough? Like, where do you stop? You take extra credit courses and you get involved in Upper House and you lead a Bible study and you go join a sports team. I mean, at some point, you're trying to fill this sort of emptiness in your own life with all kind of activities. And he suggests that everything is never enough, that we just keep going and going and going. Guess what book of the Bible it's on? Ecclesiastes. It's a study of Ecclesiastes for the postmodern 21st century world. Ecclesiastes' surprising path to resilient happiness. And so it is about just trying to find people to give you a sense of happiness. I like to talk about meaning and purpose and making a difference and all this missional vision of the kingdom stuff. But at the end of the day, you want people just to be okay, to be resilient, to cope okay, to be happy, you know? And so he just says, what's it mean to be happy? So he looks at the broader cultural context, and then he surprisingly looks at this rather bleak poet of the Old Testament, the Ecclesiastes book, and says, you know, is there sort of embedded in that vision of wisdom some sort of key to how to have some horizons to our hope? He puts Ecclesiastes into kind of dialogue with other thinkers and even, you know, voices of modernity and rock stars and stuff. So it's a real lively book. It's fun to read. It's thoughtful. And it is about wisdom and the meaning of life, but it's finally just about happiness too. So I think this is really good. Listen to Matthew Crawford, who's written some really important books on education and work, you know, and embodiment. He says it's fresh, direct, and enlivening. Jameson helps us to see the gifts that God is constantly flinging at us. So to be happy is sort of to be attentive and open to the stuff that's going on in your life. And to have that kind of wise sense that you're not trying to fill your life with stuff, but to accept God's world as a gift. So I like that a lot.
That's great.
Well, let's shift to a just slightly different tone. If those would be some beginning books for just any Christian young person wanting to kind of piece some things together and make sure they're going into college, asking good questions and being happy with the right framework and horizon of all that. A little deeper would be this assessment of the society we live in. I mentioned Everything is Never Enough does mention some cultural assessment in modernity and how Ecclesiastes is sort of a counter voice to that. There's another title. We got so many on this topic, and I know you guys really help equip people to think Christianly about their place in culture, Andy Crouch's stuff and so forth. There's a fairly new book called The Way of Christ in Culture. It's kind of thin, as you can see here. It's kind of Christ in everything and the intersection of Christianity and culture. There's been lots of books on that directly, and this just is exactly that. It's short and sweet about what does it mean to have a thoughtful Christian engagement in but not of the world around us. So how do we think about culture? How do we think about life? How do we think about society? It's by Benjamin Quinn and Dennis Creason. It's two authors I did not know. They're Southern Baptists. The book is published by Broadman and Holman, which is a Southern Baptist imprint. But then people that are not necessarily Southern Baptists, like the great Richard Mao, has a long blurb on the back. Here's what he says. So this is what Rich Mao says. I have long worried because our focus on high and popular culture, our studies of Christ and culture, leave a whole range of cultural activity out of the picture. You know, we talk about just either high culture, really highfalutin, interesting philosophical stuff, or we talk about movies and pop culture. And either the high culture or the low culture, as important as that is, it doesn't really hit most of ordinary life. And so Mao goes on and says this, not this wonderful book. I knew the authors were serious about following the way of cultural obedience in all creation when I read this savvy declaration in the first chapter. Changing a diaper, though seemingly mundane, is a magnificent act of culture making. So when Mao read that even changing a diaper has cultural implications and that our human activity to do all things before the glory of God, that's what this book tries to help us get at. Other books have done it well. Daniel Strange, who I like a lot, he directs the Crosslands Forum. He has a blurb in the back. Craig Bartholomew over in England of the Kirby Lang Center, who you draw on, I'm sure. He raves about it. And so this is sort of this broad vision of the lordship of Christ over all areas of life and how to think about culture well, as God's gifts of common grace would affirm, but also we're trying to sort of resist the culture. We don't want to be swallowed in by the world, and we want to transform the culture, no less. So he looks at some typologies and different ways to analyze this process of being in but not of the world, salt and light in the culture, but yet a city on a hill that offers light to the broken culture. I'm excited about stuff like that, and I read a book on Christ and culture, just the theories of that, probably a couple of times a year. I pick one and just, this is going to remind me of the big picture of what we're all about. And you in at the Upper House there are all about shaping students to take up their vocations in the world for the sake of Christ. And to have a Christian understanding of culture is a good backdrop to that. So I wanted to highlight that one.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Can I put another one kind of in conversation with that? This is about culture making and what it is to have a vision for all of life. And they look at theology a bit, they look at Bible a bit, but they look at the typologies of culture and the methodology of how we think about culture. I want to back up and give sort of a theological basis for doing that. And this has become, I think, my favorite intro to the Christian faith as a guide to the sort of theologies of culture. It is a brand new book that is called The Core of the Christian Faith. The Core of the Christian Faith, Living the Gospel for the Sake of the World, and it's by Michael Goheen. Goheen is a Calvin in Grand Rapids for a while. He's now in Arizona at a think tank center equipping people in ordinary churches to take their place in what he calls the Symphony of Mission. He co-wrote a book with a pastor down there in Tempe, Arizona, called the Symphony of Mission, and he uses the metaphor of an orchestra. Everybody finds their particular instrument to play. Everybody takes up their task in the music, and together we make beautiful music for the sake of the world, but nobody does it all. And so we have to find our vocation, our calling. Well, how do you equip churches to teach that symphonic missional perspective where everyone's vocation matters? And in college at Upper House, how do you encourage students, whether they're artists or scientists or biologists or political theorists or literary critics, you know, or engineers or farmers? How do you get everybody on the same page of thinking Christianly about their vocations and about God's work in the world? Well, this book lays out the theological foundations. It's the stuff he teaches to get at that symphony of mission stuff. The core of the Christian faith, living the gospel for the sake of the world. Here's the three sections. The first couple of chapters is the gospel of the kingdom. What is the gospel of Jesus? That he just died for your sins so you can go to heaven? That's not how Jesus talked about the kingdom of God. And so we have to look at the true context of the gospel, what the whole truth of the gospel is, the multifaceted vision of the kingdom. And so he looks at the gospel of the kingdom and how we continue that message of proclaiming the kingdom, restoration of all things. That's the first part. The second part is the biblical story. And that's the creation and fall and covenant and restoration, exile, the coming of Jesus, the pouring out of the Holy Spirit, the ascension of Jesus, the work of the early church. So you got from creation to new creation, you got this narrative that we live into. So we have the kingdom vision that's shaped by a narrative. That's the second part, the one essential coherent story of the plot of the Bible. And then he says, how do you put those things in conversation to create a people who are shaped by all that? And that's the third section. There's three good chapters about being a scattered people in the world, shaped by worship and church and liturgy with this grand story and sent into the world. And then the fourth unit, which is the final three chapters, is then all of that has a conversation, a missional conversation, he calls it, with the culture you're a part of. Whether that's in Swahili Africa or whether that's in bourgeoisie London, whether it's in old hippie Madison, Wisconsin, whatever your unique culture is, your missional story has to have an engagement with that missional place. So I thought this was going to be sort of the core of the Christian faith, you know, sin and restoration and forgiveness and grace and sanctification and cross, kind of systematic theology, just what it sounded like, the core of the faith. But he uses all those words, but he frames it by these four big parts. And I just think this is spectacular stuff, this missional kingdom vision, this biblical story, this becoming a people shaped by that, a community shaped by that, and then having an engagement with the culture around you. That's the core of the Christian faith as he understands it, the living the gospel for the sake of the world. It's the stuff he's been teaching out there in Arizona at this little ministry equipment center that he started to equip churches, and they've been doing that for years. And this book came out of this hands-on stuff of giving people this kingdom vision. It is really good. I'm excited, as you can tell, and that's a foundational book for those that want sort of a theological basis for all this culture making and higher education stuff that we've been talking about.
Yeah, that's great.
The podcast notes for today's conversation include a link to view this episode on YouTube. Remember to follow or subscribe to stay updated with our latest episodes in your podcast app.
You know, it's interesting about the culture dynamic. I think there's so many different theological frameworks and philosophies around culture making, culture engagement, right? Different Christian traditions have different, very different viewpoints around even culture engagement. You know, if you were going to, those sound, both books sound really great. Really excited to explore those. But if you were going to help us maybe frame a couple key books, texts that you think, I mean, the one comes to mind all the time is Andy Crouch's Culture Making, right? I mean, it's such a good volume. So I would put that in my top three. Like, if you're going to talk about culture dynamic, that has to be in there. What would be the other two volumes that you would fill in if you were going to say, hey, here's three books around culture making, culture engagement? What would be your three? We can check Andy's off, but what would be your other two? I'm curious.
Well, this just might be one of the other ones. I think this really is useful. It's easier to read. It's not too complicated, but it does look at, you know, Taylor and the spirits of modernity and some of the heady stuff you find. It's influenced by Timothy Keller and some of those sort of Calvinist traditions, neo-Calvinism, even though these guys are Baptist. Boy, you know, I that's a million-dollar question. I like almost anything Richard Mao writes. And so I do like Richard Mao a lot. I think he's ecumenical. He's gracious. He looks at the best of other theological traditions, whether it's, you know, Roman Catholic contemplatives or whether it's Wesleyan. Mm-hmm. You know, he really covers the waterfront well. He has a book that is sort of a little bit in-house for people that are in the Reformed tradition, Calvinist, you know, Presbyterians and such. But even if you're not, I think the book that he does on common grace, it's called He Shines in All That's Fair. I mean, that's a line from This Is My Father's World, right? He shines in all that's fair. Yeah. He says, is that true? Does God get glory from like fair, ordinary stuff, playing golf, you know, a good marriage, a nice piece of art? I mean, nobody gets saved by that, a good baseball pitch. But somehow, does the glory of a baseball pitch really hitting the plate right, does that make God happy? Chesterton said so. Chesterton said God is almost like that child on your lap, a grandchild that's tugging at your beard, and you do a little trick or you say something, and then the child says, do it again. Do it again. Chesterton said that's the way God is. Like, do it again. I want to do it again. God likes the pleasure of humans having delight in things. So Mao writes this fairly theological, granted in the Reformed tradition, where that becomes a debate, that phrase common grace. Some Reformed people didn't like that. And so Abram Kuyper and some of these guys argued about that. Whether you have any skin in that game of the Reformed debate about that, it's still very instructive about the biblical themes of culture, the biblical themes of what we can say that's good about culture. Does God care about all this? And some of the people that have been critics of that conversation. So that I like that. He Shines in All That's Fair. Culture and Common Grace is the subtitle by Richard Mao.
Yeah.
He wrote a sequel to it years later about caring for the things God cares about. And he even quoted me in it, which is just sort of cute. But I think He Shines in All That's Fair is one that I would highly recommend for anybody interested in deepening their sort of savvy as a biblical Christian engaged in the world around them.
That's super helpful. Super helpful.
Well, that Michael Goheen book is solid too. You know, Goheen wrote a chapter in a book that many use in this whole conversation called Creation Regained on the Development of a Christian Worldview by Albert Walters. And the original book that looked at the goodness of creation and the rampant effect of the distorting power of sin and the scope of redemption that Christ is making all things new, that Al Walters book, Creation Regained, was reissued with another chapter that Goheen wrote. So this book by Michael Goheen, he's a Newbegin scholar, Leslie Newbegin, and he wrote a Newbegin influenced chapter in the newer edition of Creation Regained. And so some people might know his name there. And as a Newbegin scholar, he understands cultural impact a lot. And so that last quarter of that book, of those four chapters, again, gets at some of those same themes. Now, on a completely different kind of theological tone, I shouldn't say tone, but a tradition. This guy is in the Pentecostal tradition and is a hefty scholar. And one of my favorite writers of all time, his name is A.J. Swoboda. And A.J. Swoboda has a book on Sabbath. He has a book on doubt. He has a book on Pentecostal influences on environmental care and environmentalism. Man, he covers a lot of ground as a scholar. This book came today. It's brand spanking new. The ink is still wet. I had an advanced copy, so I've looked at it earlier, but the new edition just came. It is called, get this, it's called Slow Theology. You've heard of slow food. There's a book called Slow Church. This is looking at eight different practices if you want resilient faith in a turbulent world. That's the subtitle. If the culture is a mess, if Christianity has sometimes dropped the ball, and now people are even complaining about Christianity and deconstructing things because we've not often been engaged in the culture in a wholesome, healthy way, and some people recognize that, and now they're mad at us. So the culture's a mess, the church is a mess, everybody's got doubts and struggles. How do you have a resilient faith in the middle of these turbulent times? And he says, well, we need to slow down. We need to think well. We need to read books. We need to care. We need to pay attention. We need to hear God's voice in a fast-paced world. Isn't that good? So it is a little bit about spiritual formation, a little bit of drawing on his great Sabbath book that he wrote about kind of ignoring the outrageous headlines that grab all the attention and settling down to a quieter exploration of the slow things that we really believe. I think Upper House people would really dig this. It is co-written with a guy named Ninjay Gupta. And Gupta is a theologian, biblical scholar, New Testament scholar of Indian descent, but he's at Northern Seminary outside of Chicago. He wrote a book really interesting last year called Strange Religion. And it's about the earliest church as they were under the boot heels of the Roman Empire and how they literally changed the world with practices that didn't make any sense to the Greco-Roman world. And so their countercultural strange practices, so to speak, which we look at now is just, you know, the basis of Western civilization. I mean, they really brought healing and hope and dignity to the world with this strange kind of practice, taking in the poor, caring about health, having rituals of inner formation like Eucharist. And so Gupta wrote this book called Strange Religion about the early church, which is pretty cool. But the two of them combined here and they wrote 8 practices for growing in these times. You want to hear what they are? I'll just rattle them off real quick.
I would love to hear. Yes.
Take your time. That's learn to linger with God. Embrace the theological journey. You know, take the long view of faith. You don't have to figure everything out today. You know, it's a journey we're on here. So put on your seatbelt and go on for the long haul to figure out some stuff. The next one is thinking slowly. And that's unlike anything I've read where he applies Sabbath principles of rest and trust of God and recreation, the Sabbath playfulness to our theological thinking. So you think slowly. So that applies Sabbath principles to theology. Ponder the mysteries. Go to the problems. That's a challenge yourself kind of not to run from difficulties, whether they're intellectual quandaries that are paradoxes we got to figure out, or whether it's personal pains and hard stuff we've seen, we got to address it and figure it out. Let pain be the altar is the next one. And that's talking with God through in the middle of our difficulties, that pain can draw us towards God. And it can, it's not that God gives us trouble on purpose, but in this troubled, broken world, we experience pain and that can become an altar, they say. That's powerful. Believe together, that's about communal theology, and don't give up is the last part, and that's a beautiful chapter as well. So this slow theology, again, offers some tools to relating this bigger question about the cores of the Christian faith, the culture making we've talked about, and how to sort of work on that stuff together slowly over the course of your college career. So I just thought that seemed helpful for an Upper House audience.
Yeah, that's great. AJ's great. We had him as a speaker here in the kind of the aftermath of the pandemic or the slowing down of the pandemic. He actually came in virtually and he spoke to college, all of our college students, his After Doubt book on you know, how to kind of deconstruct without losing your faith. And it was so good. It was very good. Yeah. So
I admire him a lot.
Yeah, he's great.
Well, another person I admire that you should bring if you haven't yet is the effervescent, wonderfully charming, really smart woman named Dr. Carmen Imes. Do you know Carmen Imes? Biblical scholar from Biola, has written some academic stuff. She's working on a commentary in Exodus, I think. This summer, she's been doing every week a video. It's not a podcast, but a video where she says, I'm going to give my 2 favorite books on a topic. But she cheats. She's like me. She cheats and she gives 2 basic ones, 2 intermediate ones. And then she says, if you're working on your PhD in this topic, here's 2 academic ones you really need. And so she'll look at Sabbath, or she'll look at lament, or she'll look at the cultural backgrounds of the Hebrews, or the, middle period between the Old and New Testament, the Maccabean period and stuff. And she'll give two books that are easy, two books that are the next level up. And so she gives you six books on everything in this topic. And then she says, people in the video, buy them from Hearts and Minds, a little brick and mortar store in South Central Pennsylvania. And I've been getting orders for these, some of the books that I know and love, so and great. Others that I never heard of before, academic stuff from Europe and stuff. I've been getting orders from all over the world. Not tons, but enough. And people say, Carmen said, you're the bookstore, we should support it. So that's been a real delight. And we're really grateful. Well, she wrote a book about being made in God's image. It's one of my all-time favorites last year. It was called Being God's Image, about creation and why creation matters. Before that, she had Bearing God's Name, which is on why Sinai matters, why the law matters. So the law, creation, and now the brand new one, it literally just came this week. It's technically not released till next month, but we got it early. It's called Becoming God's Family. So it's got the same cover as Bearing God's Name and Being God's Image, and this is Becoming God's Family. It's on the nature of the church. When the covenant community from the Old Testament on through the New Testament, the father of us all, Abraham, the growing pains and family dysfunction of the early Genesis period, the divided family. It's kind of the scope of the biblical theme of the whole narrative of the Bible, but with this view of family life as that is seen in the Bible and becomes eventually the church. So when she says family, she's meaning the community of faith and the family of siblings we are in Christ. And so the church ordained by God in the Old and New Testament still matters today. I have not read this yet. I've got an advanced copy and I've been putting it aside because I didn't think it was coming for a month and a half yet. And here it showed up. So I'm telling you about it. I'm sure it's as good as the other two that are fantastic. I haven't even looked at it yet. You know, Caitlin Scheiss is a woman. She's a political theorist, has two books on politics that I love. She's down at Duke now. And she wrote, even though skeptical of the church, we'll find in these pages a compelling vision of Christian faith that not only teaches us right doctrine, but envelops us into a family. And I like that we're enfolded into a community. You know, we belong to something. And in a certain sense, what we believe emerges from who we belong to. It used to be in many Christian theologies, you had to believe the right things before you were allowed to belong. You know, you couldn't enter the Christian faith unless you checked off all the stuff you claimed you believed. Well, Doubting Thomas was kind of a good guy because he wants to know the truth of things. So it's good to be on a quest and to doubt. But I'm not sure if she exactly puts it like this. But for some of us, the belonging is sort of the setting for our believing rather than believing in order to belong. You belong in order to believe. So we become a member of a community, and that community shapes who we are and what we are and how we care about things and ultimately what our theology is. So granted, you have to believe in Jesus and stuff to get baptized into Christian faith, but the shape of our theology and our worldview and our culture making and our activities with our vocations and so forth, all of that really happens in community. I'm convinced of it. So I think she's onto something here, that we have to explore the nature of the church. And this isn't the book that it's just about ecclesiology, about the church kind of small c and how do you have congregational life and why should you be part of a small group and stuff. It's more the broader biblical story of how becoming a part of a family is part of the biblical drama. So that's part of a story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, can I change gears here? Something listeners here that are trying to keep up with us, Daniel. I think that to get at this question of being a family, we have to listen well to each other. And I've got a whole list of books on listening and telling your narratives and being part of a story and our own story. I mean, that's a whole nother podcast we could do sometimes. Mm-hmm. But let me just say this. I think we can really enjoy and benefit from reading memoirs. Just stories of people telling about their lives, whether you agree with them or not, whether you like them or not, just the story of people, you know, immigrants coming to this country, learning how they navigated things, or, you know, people whose Chinese mother taught them a certain way to cook rice. And so they write a book about, you know, how their Chinese parents shaped them or something, you know, just all kind of interesting memoirs that are out there. This is one that I am excited to read. It just came. It's brand spanking new, so it's great for the fall. It's by Austin Channing Brown, who is an African-American woman, young woman, who wrote a book called I'm Still Here. I'm guessing in about 1920, 21, maybe five years ago, maybe. I'm Still Here was a tremendous book about a young evangelical Black woman navigating spheres of largely white culture as a Black young lady. Her parents knew some things about this, and they named her Austin and gave her the last name Channing because it didn't sound Black. And in fact, Austin sounds like a boy. So she's even up against, you know, the discrimination against women, and they just didn't want her name to be saddled with certain sorts of things. And I think that in itself is just remarkably interesting. I'm Still Here is one of my all-time favorite memoirs. My wife would say the same thing. Really well-written, short read. Well, this is now the long-awaited sequel to it. It is called Full of Myself, Full of Myself, Black Womanhood and the Journey to Self-Possession. What does it mean to come into your own? What does it mean to become who you are meant to be? What does it mean to be happy with yourself? I don't know where she stands in terms of her own faith at the end of this book. I haven't read it yet, but she does look at chronic pain. She looks at sadness. She says, I love myself when I'm holding on. There's a chapter called I Love Myself When I'm Embodied. They're sort of short chapters. I don't want to say they're essays. Makes it sound too dry and abstract. These are stories from her life, and they're woven together as like a series of essays that become, that become a memoir. Full of Myself. Some famous people, movie stars and stuff, have endorsements from the back of this, which is kind of interesting. Some Black writers that we know well. Cole Arthur Riley, who for a while worked over at Chesterton House, one of your compatriot institutes. Cole Riley says the catharsis that we all need, from destructive bosses to beauty salons to the haunt of a hospital bed, Brown is one of the most honest storytellers we have today. So I like Cole's endorsement there, an honest storyteller. So that may be something that people might want to dive into this fall, a couple of stories of memoirs, and I think Austin Channing Brown will be provocative and interesting.
That's great.
Well,
do you have other memoirs?
I know we're running out of time here. Do we have time for just a couple more?
I was going to ask you about the memoirs thing. I think the memoirs thing is super interesting. You know, you have some super famous memoirs that have been distributed in the past. You know, I think of the Steve Jobs Apple one that was, you know, just got tons of things. One that I've really enjoyed recently has been the Bono one.
So good.
And it's just so good. So I read it, and then I also downloaded it as an audiobook, and they weave in the music into it and stuff. And Byron, I'm wondering about the memoir piece. Like, what does that tell us about our faith or our humanity when we hear other people's stories?
Oh, my. That's a great question. Well, I think one of the things it does in our own faith, it might create more empathy. That we come to sort of see the cracks in other people's lives, how they make sense of their own story, how they tell their own story. If it's writerly and well done, you're like, wow, that is amazingly beautiful, even when they're writing about something sort of painful. So it can give us an admiration to walk a mile in the other person's shoes, as they say. Mm-hmm. And that's virtue. I mean, that's important to have empathy. So if this will help us sort of appreciate the complexities of other people's lives, and then there, but for the grace of God go I, you know, is that saying, you see your own life maybe as a little bit a bit of a story. Some people don't really kind of have the long view of their lives and reflect on kind of how God has been faithful over time and brought them. My friend Margie Hack, who's up sort of near you guys, Margie Hack has a trilogy of memoirs that are amongst my favorites. But the first one about her growing up really poor and up way up above Minnesota in the rural areas and poor and in a pretty brutal family. And the book is called The Exact Place. That in retrospect, when she looked back over her life, she saw she was right where she needed to be, when she needed to be there for the next thing to happen. And one thing led to another. She connects the dots and she becomes a Christian with great faith and a great story to tell. And so The Exact Place is sort of a beautiful memoir and kind of funny about her growing up rural in a pretty rough shotgun shack in Minnesota and how she came to Christian faith. The next book is about her marrying Dennis Hack, who ran for years and years and years Ransom Fellowship and influenced by the Schaeffers and so forth. And that's about there in the late 60s, going out and being part of a Jesus community out west to minister to drug dealers and stuff. What a story. And so this narrative of a life looked back upon, you begin to see maybe I was in the in the right place at the right time. Maybe God had something to do with that. And so you can not only have more empathy by reading somebody's story, you can also maybe be more self-reflective about where God has shown up in your own life as you've looked at the consolations and the desolations of your own path. Does that make sense?
I think that's great. And I think that those are just very wise words of wisdom. I think, you know, hearing other people's stories is so important. It helps us also find our own voice and our own story, I think, when we hear someone else's. And I think it's a really important piece. And I am not a memoir reader, so you're inspiring me to take a look and take a listen with others.
If anybody goes to our website, all our old Book Notes newsletter that we do every week or so are all archived. And about 2 years ago, I got to do a retreat with a group of pastors on the power of reading. And I developed for that workshop my 50 favorite memoirs. 50. Not annotated. Well, they're annotated, like one sentence about each one, telling you kind of what it's about. I didn't review them. And then I actually did the same thing for novels. I picked 50 novels. And you can find that. You have to download it. You know, you look at the book notes and put in memoirs or something. I bet it'll come up. And it's 50 random, often not people of faith, but sometimes people of faith, telling their story. Austin Channing's I'm Still Here is one of those 50. But this Full of Myself is just one that I wanted to pitch out for now.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, I got another book that is one of my favorite books of this new season. I read it outside, sitting in a chair outside, called You Can Trust a God with Scars. By Jared Ayers. And I could say a few things about Jared because I knew his father growing up. He inspired me as a high school kid. We went to the same high school together, and his father became a leader at Lancaster Bible College near us. And Jared is a Presbyterian pastor now. But it is not a memoir, but he tells so many stories of his own life, the loss of his mother at a young age, his own struggles with doubt, his work as a pastor, meeting skeptics along the way in a college town. He was in Philly. He would write his sermons sometimes at this coffee shop, and a certain skeptic would show up every single week, and they became friends. And it's like, well, what are you talking about this week, Reverend? Father, he would call him. What are you reading about this week, Father? And they would talk theology over coffee with this agnostic that never came to church. He talked about people coming to his church and finding faith finally. So it is not a memoir straight through, but there's lots of personal stories. But the bottom line of this really astute book is that if you want to know who God is, you must realize that he has scars, that he cares about the human creation, and that Jesus died for us. And that says something about the credibility of the divine. The God that we point people to is you can trust a God with scars. It's about faith and doubt, you know, for the searching soul. Good for anybody. There's lots of pop culture allusions. He's smart and fun. Talks about movies and stuff. So I really like Jared Ayers. It came out on Nav Press just a couple of weeks ago, and it's one of my favorite books. Not quite a memoir, but it's very, very nice. I've got a bunch that aren't even out yet. I know we're wrapping up. Can I just name a few that are coming this fall that are going to be real important books?
Give us your rapid fire list. Yeah.
In a couple of weeks, The Gospel After Christendom, An Introduction to Cultural Apologetics. It's by Colin Hansen and people at the Tim Keller Center, Analyzing the Culture and What We Mean by Cultural Apologetics. That's the street date is September 16th. Also early September is a book called Ask of Old Paths. That's a line from Jeremiah, by the way. Ask of the Old Paths. It looks at medieval virtues and vices for a holy life today. It's by a medievalist. She wrote an earlier book on the medieval views of Jesus. And this is the medieval views of virtues. It's by a woman named Grace Hammond, coming out from Zondervan in about 2 weeks. It's going to be spectacular, I'm sure of it. I haven't seen it yet, but it's on my long-awaited list. Mako Fujimara, the great artist on Yale University Press, has a book coming out called Art Is. The subtitle is A Journey into the Light. It'll be on Yale University Press. It comes out the end of October. So that's one of the fall books that we're all going to be looking forward to. At the end of September, there is a book that I am hoping Upper House orders from us or from somebody. This is an important scholarly work for leaders in the kind of work you guys do. It's called Christianity and Intellectual Inquiry, Thinking as pilgrimage. We started with a book about learning as pilgrimage for the student. This is perhaps for faculty or anyone interested in deep philosophical learning. Doug Jacobson had taught at Messiah and had written a book on Oxford University Press a good number of years ago on why learning from the Anabaptist tradition, the Mennonite Anabaptist tradition and the Brethren tradition, might look a little different as you think about developing the mind of Christ and integrating faith and learning in a culture. That just has some different nuances and postures if you're an Anabaptist. So they wrote a book to complement George Marsden and others that have written a book about the Christian mind out of their uniquely Anabaptist perspective. That was a really important book. They edited that with other Mennonite authors. This and Doug and his wife, Rhonda, wrote together. It's coming from Oxford University Press, coming out the end of September. And it really does look at learning and intellectual inquiry as a pilgrimage. And therefore, we need pilgrim practices, attentiveness, and so forth, to do it well. It's looking at these intellectual pathways, they call them, on this journey that they think is particularly important in the sort of postmodern world that we live in now. So as people have increasingly gone to college for the wrong reasons, or think that intellectual inquiry is mostly about finding yourself, this sort of sense of identity, that we need a different kind of way to talk about what learning really is and what intellectual inquiry can be. And they call it a pilgrimage. Isn't that interesting? So that's coming out from Oxford. I haven't seen it yet. I've read all about it. I read the first chapter. And that's as far as I could see at this point. But the book is coming in September. Doug and Rhonda Jacobson, Oxford University Press. I think it's one that that the study center movement is going to benefit from a lot.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Byron, as always, we are so grateful for your work, for Hearts and Minds, and just the way that you embody really important works and able to draw us into that. And your recommendations, I know, are really important to our community. So we really appreciate all that you do and really grateful for Hearts and Minds and the decades of legacy that you have really helping people find their identity in Christ.
Well, thank you. Your great questions spur me on. And I'm glad there's people like you out there that are good readers and good thinkers for the glory of God.
Well, like always, we encourage folks to buy their books from Hearts and Minds. And if you go to their website, which we'll have in the show notes, the link there, fill out a form and send in what your requests are. And Byron and his team, I'm sure, will find those for you. All the links to all the books that we discussed today will also be in the show notes. So definitely check those out. And Byron, we're excited to have you back sometime soon. And we look forward to seeing the work that you're doing out in Pennsylvania and how that influences us here in Madison. We're grateful for that.
Thank you.
Well, go in peace, friends.
Thank you for tuning into the Upwards podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. For more information about the S.L. Brown Foundation and Upper House, please visit slbf.org. Go in peace to be a light on our campuses, in our churches, and in our businesses, so that all may flourish.